Hi, this is Pastor Matt, and I want to welcome you to our Blue Oaks Church podcast. At the end of this episode, feel free to download our Blue Oaks Church app, where you'll be able to access resources, events, and ways to get connected at Blue Oaks and in the community. The app is the easiest way to share this content with a friend, and it's the easiest way to keep up with everything going on around Blue Oaks. Most importantly, though, I just hope that you enjoy this episode and it inspires you to take your next step in your faith journey. Well, good morning. If we haven't met, Matt, I'm the teaching pastor here at Blue Oaks, and this is the part of the service where I get to talk, and you get to resist the urge to check your phone. If you are new or just kind of exploring faith, I'm really glad you're here. I think you picked a good week to be here. Last week, we launched this series in Romans by looking at the end first. Instead of beginning with Paul's theology, we began with a vision of the kind of community Paul is trying to form. People marked by humility, people that love and don't keep score, and are willing to lay down personal freedom for the sake of someone else. It's the kind of life that when you actually hear it described, it's like you don't have to be convinced that it's good. You don't need a theological argument for it. There's something in you that immediately says, yes, this is the kind of life I want to live. At the same time, it's not the kind of life that we naturally drift into. Left to ourselves, we tend to move in a different direction toward protecting ourselves and managing how we're perceived and holding on to control and building a life that revolves around us. So underneath everything that we looked at last week, there's really a deeper question. Where does this kind of life actually come from? Not like an idea or theory, but like in reality, like how do we actually become this kind of person? And this is where Paul makes an important turn in this letter. So for 11 chapters, he carefully builds a theological foundation. He walks through the reality of sin and the meaning of grace and what it means to be justified by faith and the life in the Spirit and what that looks like and how God has been faithful to his promises. And he doesn't rush through that. He lays the groundwork. And then in Romans 12, he shifts. And not away from theology, but into what theology is meant to produce. This is what he writes. Therefore, I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy. Now, we need to slow down when we get to that phrase, in view of God's mercy, so that we realize just how much is packed into that. Paul isn't just introducing a new idea. He is like anchoring everything that comes next. The word therefore is his way of gathering up everything that he's already written and saying, if you see this clearly, well, then everything else will make sense. And the lens that he gives us to look through is mercy. It's not effort, not progress, not potential. It's mercy. When Paul talks about mercy, he's not referring to a general idea of God being kind. He's talking about something much more specific. It's the kind of compassion that moves towards someone in need, not because they deserve it, but because that's who God is. In the first century world, mercy wasn't seen as a virtue. In Roman culture, people valued strength and status and self-sufficiency. Mercy would have been seen as a weakness, something that disrupted the natural order of power and hierarchy. And it's into that world that Paul says the defining reality of your life with God is mercy. N.T. Wright describes Romans as the story of how God is putting the world right. And mercy is where that story becomes personal. It's where what God has done in Jesus shapes how we actually live. Paul doesn't start Romans 12 with what we should do. He starts it with what's already true because of what God has done. And when we trace that through what he's already said in Romans, you kind of see the depth of it. In Romans 3, He writes that even though all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, we are still justified freely by his grace. And that word freely carries a sense of something that is given as a gift. It's not earned, it's not achieved, it's not negotiated. And then in Romans 5, he says, but God demonstrates his own love for us in this, while we were still sinners, Christ died for us, which means God's movement toward us didn't begin in our best moment. It began in the middle of our brokenness before anything had been resolved. And then in Romans 8, there is now, therefore, no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. Not less condemnation, not delayed condemnation. None. So when Paul says, in view of God's mercy, he's kind of gathering all of this together and saying, let this be the way you see your life. And that's important because if we don't start there, we almost inevitably drift into a different way of relating to God. We may not say it out loud, but over time, our motivation begins to shift. Instead of responding to mercy, we start operating out of pressure. The pressure to improve, maybe the pressure to prove that we're growing, the pressure to show that our lives are moving in the right direction. And that shift is subtle. It shows up in ways that we evaluate ourselves. You know, if we feel like we're having a good week, well, then we feel close to God. If our week is difficult, then we feel like he's distant. And without realizing it, we've moved from living in response to mercy to living in response to performance. And you can feel that shift when your relationship with God starts to sound like an internal performance review. You know, like overall, not bad, a few areas for improvement, and I'll circle back next week. Which starts to feel less like a relationship and more like a progress report. And Paul knows that instinct. So before he says anything about sacrifice, before he talks about surrender, he brings us back to this foundation and says, make sure you see your life clearly. Because the direction of the Christian life is not upward. It's not like we're moving up and like, you know, climbing our way toward God. It's outward. It's a response to what God has already done. Another way to say it is, the Christian life is not driven by the question, what do I need to do to be accepted? It's shaped by the reality that in Christ, I already am. And when that begins to settle into the way you think, not just as an idea, but something you actually live from, it changes how you approach everything. And that's what opens the door to what Paul says next. Because once you begin to see your life in view of God's mercy, he says, offer your bodies as a living sacrifice. Now, the language he uses here would have immediately stood out to his original audience, because in both Jewish worship and the broader Roman world, sacrifice was just a normal part of religious life. Temples were places where offerings were made regularly. Animals were brought and placed on an altar and given over to the gods. It was a visible, physical act that represented devotion and allegiance, and in many cases, an attempt to secure favor. And so when Paul uses this word sacrifice, he's drawing on something that people would have just understood intuitively. A sacrifice was something that was costly. It was something that was set apart. And once you placed it on the altar, it no longer belonged to you. But then Paul does something unexpected with this idea. He doesn't say, bring a sacrifice. He says, offer your bodies as a living sacrifice. Which when you stop and think about it, it almost sounds like a contradiction. In the ancient world, a sacrifice was placed on the altar and it was left there. And what makes this different is that Paul is describing a life that continues living. It's fully engaged, fully present, yet entirely surrendered. Dallas Willard would say that this is the difference between trying to fit God into your life and actually placing your life in God's hands. And notice how concrete he makes it. It doesn't say offer your intentions or offer your beliefs. Offer your bodies, which means this is not just about what you think is true. It's about how you live in the physical, everyday reality of your life. It's about what you do with your time and what you do with your energy and what you do with your attention and how you respond in ordinary moments. In other words, Paul is bringing worship out of the abstract and into the everyday, which would have been a shift for the people then just as much as it is for us now. Because in both the ancient world and in our society today, there's a tendency to separate what is spiritual from the rest of life, to think of worship as something that happens in a specific place, at a specific time, in a specific way, something that we all just experienced, to think of worship as something that happens that way. But Paul brings worship out of that box, and he says, this is your true and proper worship. That phrase can also carry the idea of something that's fitting or reasonable. Not because it's easy, but because it's the response that makes sense in light of everything that God has done. In other words, when you begin to see God's mercy clearly, this kind of response isn't too much. It's the only response that actually fits. And that reshapes what we think about surrender, because surrender in this sense is not about losing your life. It's about placing it where it was always meant to be. And this is where it becomes very personal, because offering your life to God in this way rarely shows up in just dramatic moments in your life. It shows up in ordinary decisions that you make, in how you respond when you're interrupted, in how you speak when you're frustrated, in what you choose when no one is watching. It shows up in the small, repeated choices that form the direction of your life. The phrase living sacrifice also carries a kind of tension with it, because it means this is not something you do once and then you move on. It's something you return to again and again and again, which is why the challenge with a living sacrifice is it always tries to climb off the altar. Not dramatically, but just gradually in small ways. You place your life in God's hands, but then you kind of put it back. You try to take it back. You may take your schedule back. You may take your plans back. You may take your attitude back. You may take that one conversation where you already know what you're going to say. Which is why this isn't about reaching a point where surrender becomes effortless. It's about continuing to return to it. Not out of pressure, but in response to God's mercy. And this brings us back to what we were just talking about, because when your life begins to move in this direction, when it starts to shift from being something that you're trying to control to something that you're willing to entrust to God, it doesn't just affect what you do. It begins to reshape the way you think, the assumptions you carry, the way you interpret your life, even what feels important or urgent to you. And that's why Paul moves where he does next. He says, do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. In Paul's world, conforming wasn't just about ideas. It was actually about survival. To belong in Roman society, you adopted its values. You aligned with its priorities. You learned how to fit into its systems of status and honor. And so when Paul says, do not conform, he's not talking about small adjustments here. He's talking about resisting a very powerful cultural current. And what he's doing here is naming something that's already happening in every one of our lives. We are being formed, you and I. All the time. The question is not if we're being formed. The question is, what is forming us? Let me show you what this looks like. Malcolm Gladwell, he's probably one of my favorite authors. I have a number, but anyway, Malcolm Gladwell, read some of this stuff. It's really fascinating. He writes about a shift that's happened in New York City in the 1990s. when crime rates dropped dramatically. And one of the ideas behind it was surprisingly simple. Instead of focusing on major crime, they started addressing just small signs of disorder. It's like broken windows and graffiti and fare evasion on the subway, which, and the insight about this was when the environment signals disorder, well, people will behave that way. And so they cleaned up the subway and they paid attention to the small things and they changed the environment. And over time, behavior actually changed. And what's fascinating about it is it wasn't about telling people that they needed to behave differently. It was about recognizing that people are always being shaped by what is surrounding them. And that's exactly what Paul is naming here. We are being formed, you and I, all the time, which means do not conform is not just like spiritual language. It's a call to become aware of what is shaping you. When Paul talks about the pattern of this world, he's describing a way of thinking or a set of assumptions about reality that shapes how people live. In his world, the pattern was shaped by the Roman Empire, a culture built on status and power and visibility and hierarchy. Your worth was tied to where you stood in that system and how others perceived you. To not conform meant to learn to live differently in the middle of all of that cultural pressure. And while our world looks very different on the surface, the underlying dynamics of it are not all that different. We're still being formed by patterns that tell us what makes a life meaningful, what makes a person valuable, what is worth pursuing, what success looks like. And the difference is that those patterns now come at us constantly, and not just through culture broadly, but through the steady, unceasing flow of information that we live in. And this is where Paul's words feel incredibly current, because the primary place where information is happening in our lives right now is in our minds. What we give our attention to, what we return to, what we dwell on. One of the defining realities of our day is that there are entire systems designed to capture your attention and to keep it, because your attention is extremely valuable. And what holds your attention begins to shape who you are. It shapes your thinking. And so the question is not, what do I believe? It's what is consistently forming how I think. Because your attention is not neutral. It's actually forming you. What you consistently pay attention to doesn't just inform you. It forms you. It trains you. It trains what you notice. It trains what you react to. It trains what you value. It trains what feels normal. And over time, it creates a kind of default setting in your thinking. And so when Paul talks about the renewing of the mind, he's not talking about some like occasional inspiration. He's talking about like repatterning what feels natural to you. And this is where something else becomes really important to understand, because most of life doesn't happen in slow, careful, thought out moments. Gladwell tells a story of a military simulation where a retired general was playing the role of the enemy. And the US military had all the advantages. They had technology and data and advanced strategy. This general did something completely different, though. He relied on his instinct. He relied on his experience and the pattern recognition that he had. And early in the simulation, he just overwhelmed them, because they were analyzing and he was responding. And Gladwell's point is, in real moments, you don't rise to your intentions. You fall to who you have become. And that's exactly why this is so important, because in the moment, that the moments that actually shape your life, you're not stopping. You're not like rethinking everything. You're just responding from who you've already become. And Paul is saying, let that be shaped by something different. And of course, this idea is nothing new, right? Jesus speaks so directly to this in Luke 6. He says a good tree produces good fruit. Well, good morning. If we haven't met, Matt, I'm the teaching pastor here at Blue Oaks, and this is the part of the service where I get to talk, and you get to resist the urge to check your phone. If you are new or just kind of exploring faith, I'm really glad you're here. I think you picked a good week to be here. Last week, we launched this series in Romans by looking at the end first. Instead of beginning with Paul's theology, we began with a vision of the kind of community Paul is trying to form. People marked by humility, a people that love and don't keep score, and are willing to lay down personal freedom for the sake of someone else. It's the kind of life that when you actually hear it described, it's like you don't have to be convinced that it's good. You don't need a theological argument for it. There's something in you that immediately says, yes, this is the kind of life I want to live. At the same time, it's not the kind of life that we naturally drift into. Left to ourselves, we tend to move in a different direction toward protecting ourselves and managing how we're perceived and holding on to control and building a life that revolves around us. So underneath everything that we looked at last week, there's really a deeper question. Where does this kind of life actually come from? Not like an idea or theory, but like in reality, like how do we actually become this kind of person? And this is where Paul makes an important turn in this letter. So for 11 chapters, he carefully builds a theological foundation. He walks through the reality of sin and the meaning of grace and what it means to be justified by faith and the life in the Spirit and what that looks like and how God has been faithful to his promises. And he doesn't rush through that. He lays the groundwork. And then in Romans 12, he shifts. And not away from theology, but into what theology is meant to produce. This is what he writes. Therefore, I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy. Now, we need to slow down when we get to that phrase, in view of God's mercy, so that we realize just how much is packed into that. Paul isn't just introducing a new idea. He is like anchoring everything that comes next. The word therefore is his way of gathering up everything that he's already written and saying, if you see this clearly, well, then everything else will make sense. And the lens that he gives us to look through is mercy. It's not effort, not progress, not potential. It's mercy. When Paul talks about mercy, he's not referring to a general idea of God being kind. He's talking about something much more specific. It's the kind of compassion that moves towards someone in need, not because they deserve it, but because that's who God is. In the first century world, mercy wasn't seen as a virtue. In Roman culture, people valued strength and status and self-sufficiency. Mercy would have been seen as a weakness, something that disrupted the natural order of power and hierarchy. And it's into that world that Paul says, the defining reality of your life with God is mercy. N.T. Wright describes Romans as the story of how God is putting the world right. And mercy is where that story becomes personal. It's where what God has done in Jesus shapes how we actually live. Paul doesn't start Romans 12 with what we should do. He starts it with what's already true because of what God has done. And when we trace that through what he's already said in Romans, you kind of see the depth of it. In Romans 3, he writes that even though all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, we are still justified freely by his grace. And that word freely carries a sense of something that is given as a gift. It's not earned, it's not achieved, it's not negotiated. And then in Romans 5, he says, but God demonstrates his own love for us in this, while we were still sinners, Christ died for us, which means God's movement toward us didn't begin in our best moment. It began in the middle of our brokenness before anything had been resolved. And then in Romans 8, there is now therefore no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. Not less condemnation, not delayed condemnation, none. So when Paul says, in view of God's mercy, he's kind of gathering all of this together and saying, let this be the way you see your life. And that's important because if we don't start there, we almost inevitably drift into a different way of relating to God. We may not say it out loud, but over time, our motivation begins to shift. Instead of responding to mercy, we start operating out of pressure. The pressure to improve, maybe the pressure to prove that we're growing, the pressure to show that our lives are moving in the right direction. And that shift is subtle. It shows up in ways that we evaluate ourselves. You know, if we feel like we're having a good week, well, then we feel close to God. If our week is difficult, then we feel like he's distant. And without realizing it, we've moved from living in response to mercy to living in response to performance. And you can feel that shift when your relationship with God starts to sound like an internal performance review. You know, like overall, not bad, a few areas for improvement, and I'll circle back next week. Which starts to feel less like a relationship and more like a progress report. And Paul knows that instinct. So before he says anything about sacrifice, before he talks about surrender, he brings us back to this foundation and says, make sure you see your life clearly. Because the direction of the Christian life is not upward. It's not like we're moving up and like, you know, climbing our way toward God. It's outward. It's a response to what God has already done. Another way to say it is, the Christian life is not driven by the question, what do I need to do to be accepted? It's shaped by the reality that in Christ, I already am. And when that begins to settle into the way you think, not just as an idea, but something you actually live from, it changes how you approach everything. And that's what opens the door to what Paul says next. Because once you begin to see your life in view of God's mercy, he says, offer your bodies as a living sacrifice. Now, the language he uses here would have immediately stood out to his original audience, because in both Jewish worship and the broader Roman world, sacrifice was just a normal part of religious life. Temples were places where offerings were made regularly. Animals were brought and placed on an altar and given over to the gods. It was a visible, physical act that represented devotion and allegiance, and in many cases, an attempt to secure favor. And so when Paul uses this word sacrifice, he's drawing on something that people would have just understood intuitively. A sacrifice was something that was costly. It was something that was set apart. And once you placed it on the altar, it no longer belonged to you. But then Paul does something unexpected with this idea. He doesn't say, bring a sacrifice. He says, offer your bodies as a living sacrifice. Which, when you stop and think about it, it almost sounds like a contradiction. In the ancient world, a sacrifice was placed on the altar and it was left there. And what makes this different is that Paul is describing a life that continues living. It's fully engaged, fully present, yet entirely surrendered. Dallas Willard would say that this is the difference between trying to fit God into your life and actually placing your life in God's hands. And notice how concrete he makes it. It doesn't say offer your intentions or offer your beliefs. Offer your bodies, which means this is not just about what you think is true. It's about how you live in the physical, everyday reality of your life. It's about what you do with your time and what you do with your energy and what you do with your attention and how you respond in ordinary moments. In other words, Paul is bringing worship out of the abstract and into the everyday, which would have been a shift for the people then just as much as it is for us now. Because in both the ancient world and in our society today, there's a tendency to separate what is spiritual from the rest of life. To think of worship as something that happens in a specific place, at a specific time, in a specific way, something that we all just experienced. To think of worship as something that happens that way, but Paul brings worship out of that box. And he says, this is your true and proper worship. That phrase can also carry the idea of something that's fitting or reasonable. Not because it's easy, but because it's the response that makes sense in light of everything that God has done. In other words, when you begin to see God's mercy clearly, this kind of response isn't too much. It's the only response that actually fits. And that reshapes what we think about surrender, because surrender in this sense is not about losing your life. It's about placing it where it was always meant to be. And this is where it becomes very personal, because offering your life to God in this way rarely shows up in just dramatic moments in your life. It shows up in ordinary decisions that you make, in how you respond when you're interrupted, in how you speak when you're frustrated, in what you choose when no one is watching. It shows up in the small, repeated choices that form the direction of your life. The phrase living sacrifice also carries a kind of tension with it, because it means this is not something you do once and then you move on. It's something you return to again and again and again, which is why the challenge with a living sacrifice is it always tries to climb off the altar. Not dramatically, but just gradually in small ways. You place your life in God's hands, but then you kind of put it back. You try to take it back. You may take your schedule back, you may take your plans back, you may take your attitude back, you may take that one conversation where you already know what you're gonna say, which is why this isn't about reaching a point where surrender becomes effortless. It's about continuing to return to it, not out of pressure, but in response to God's mercy. And this brings us back to what we were just talking about, because when your life begins to move in this direction, when it starts to shift from being something that you're trying to control to something that you're willing to entrust to God, it doesn't just affect what you do, it begins to reshape the way you think, the assumptions you carry, the way you interpret your life, even what feels important or urgent to you. And that's why Paul moves where he does next. He says, do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. In Paul's world, conforming wasn't just about ideas. It was actually about survival. To belong in Roman society, you adopted its values. You aligned with its priorities. You learned how to fit into its systems of status and honor. And so when Paul says, do not conform, he's not talking about small adjustments here. He's talking about resisting a very powerful cultural current. And what he's doing here is naming something that's already happening in every one of our lives. We are being formed, you and I, all the time. The question is not if we're being formed. The question is, what is forming us? Let me show you what this looks like. Malcolm Gladwell, he's probably one of my favorite authors. I have a number, but anyway, Malcolm Gladwell, read some of this stuff. It's really fascinating. He writes about a shift that's happened in New York City in the 1990s. When crime rates dropped dramatically. And one of the ideas behind it was surprisingly simple. Instead of focusing on major crime, they started addressing just small signs of disorder. It's like broken windows and graffiti and fare evasion on the subway, which, and the insight about this was, when the environment signals disorder, well, people will behave that way. And so they cleaned up the subway. and they paid attention to the small things, and they changed the environment. And over time, behavior actually changed. And what's fascinating about it is it wasn't about telling people that they needed to behave differently. It was about recognizing that people are always being shaped by what is surrounding them. And that's exactly what Paul is naming here. We are being formed, you and I, all the time. Which means do not conform is not just like spiritual language. It's a call to become aware of what is shaping you. When Paul talks about the pattern of this world, he's describing a way of thinking or a set of assumptions about reality that shapes how people live. In his world, the pattern was shaped by the Roman Empire, a culture built on status and power and visibility and hierarchy. Your worth was tied to where you stood in that system and how others perceived you. To not conform meant to learn to live differently in the middle of all of that cultural pressure. And while our world looks very different on the surface, the underlying dynamics of it are not all that different. We're still being formed by patterns that tell us what makes a life meaningful, what makes a person valuable, what is worth pursuing, what success looks like. And the difference is that those patterns now come at us constantly, and not just through culture broadly, but through the steady, unceasing flow of information that we live in. And this is where Paul's words feel incredibly current, because the primary place where information is happening in our lives right now is in our minds.
Hey, once again, thanks for listening. We hope you found something in this week's message to take away and apply to your life this week. If you live in the Bay Area, we would love to have you join us for one of our weekend services. For directions or information about what we have for you or your family, your students, you can go to blueoaks.church or download the app today. And we hope to see you on Sunday soon.